Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is David L. Roll, author of George Marshall, Defender of the Republic. David L. Roll is the author of The Hopkins Touch, Harry Hopkins and the Forging of the Alliance to Defeat Hitler, and is the co-author of Lewis Johnson and the Arming of America, which was a biography of Harry Truman's defense secretary. He's senior counsel at Steptoe & Johnson, a Washington, D.C.-based international law firm. He's a non-resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund and the founder of Lex Mundi Pro Bono Foundation, a public interest organization that provides pro bono legal services to social entrepreneurs around the world. So Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. So during a conversation with Eisenhower, FDR reportedly said, "I hate to think that 50 years from now, practically nobody will know who George Marshall was." Now, of course, our regular Army of the Matters listeners are familiar with Marshall, but for the benefit of others, could you just give a quick overview of the man and his accomplishments?
Sure. George Marshall first rose to prominence in 1918 during the Great War when he planned and executed a brilliant nighttime movement, believe it or not, of 600,000 troops over a 13-day period, putting him in a place to fight and win the decisive battle that ended the First World War. And General Pershing, who was in charge of all the American forces in Europe or in France, made him his closest personal aide after the war. So in World War II, Marshall was chief of staff of the entire U.S. Army. And That's when he organized and he trained and he supplied. He was in charge of all that, of an army of more than 8 million men and women. He also, at that time, was the dominant voice in matters of Allied strategy and the British and the American Joint Chiefs of Staff organization.
Right.
It was not only the voice of grand strategy, but in terms of the deployment of Allied troops throughout the world. After the war, he served a year in China as a special envoy for President Truman, Mission Impossible, forge a coalition, a government between the Chinese nationalists and the Chinese communists. He failed. Secretary of State pushed through the Marshall Plan, which restored the Western Europe economies. He laid the groundwork for NATO. He oversaw the Berlin airlift. He famously lost his temper in front of President Truman in a showdown in the Oval Office over the Truman's decision to recognize the new state of Israel. President of the American Red Cross. And after that, Truman called upon him again to become Secretary of Defense, where he helped rebuild the army that had been depleted following the Second World War. And he, with surprising reluctance, oversaw the relief of General Douglas MacArthur. And, oh yeah, can't forget, he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in 1953.
Well, it's an incredible resume, an incredible list of accomplishments. And
retired in 1951, died in 1959.
Wow. And, you know, at the beginning of all those accomplishments, you know, you referenced his time in the First World War and planning the maneuver before the Meuse-Argonne campaign. A couple other moments from that war, you know, he had talked about himself that, you know, he regarded the Cantini operation as a defining moment. And you also saw a moment there with Pershing where, you know, it was a first example, really, of his ability to be brutally candid with superior officers.
So, truth to power.
Yeah. So, you know, why was World War, you know, can you give us a little bit more about World War I and what he was doing there?
Marshall was a an officer, I think he was a major at the time, in the 1st Division, the big red one. The 1st Division was the first division that went to France in 1917 after we declared war in April. And after the General Siebert, walked down the gangplank in France, Marshall was the second to put his foot on the ground in France during the war. Marshall was in charge of helping train the elements of the 1st Division. And one day they had a maneuver, some sort of live fire exercise. And Pershing arrived on the train to observe the exercise. And the general in charge, General Siebert, wasn't there for some reason. I guess Pershing came early or something. So Marshall greeted Pershing at the train, took him to the exercise. Pershing just hit the ceiling when the maneuver was over. And he just launched into a criticism of everything that was going on. And Marshall stood up and said, "General Pershing, I've been here from the beginning. Let me speak." And moved right up close to Pershing. And all the other officers in the 1st Division were watching this encounter. And Marshall just reeled off a fusillade of facts, most of which blamed Pershing's headquarters for the deficiencies in the maneuver. you know, lack of equipment, confusing instructions, all kinds of things like that. And Pershing was kind of uncomfortable. Pershing was starting to get ready to leave, and he said, "Well, I'll look into it." And Marshall grabbed him by the shoulder to prevent him from leaving, said, "You don't have to look into it, General. These are the facts." Well, he then walked away, and mm-hmm. all of Marshall's friends thought that he was done for.
Not surprisingly, yep.
But Pershing turned out to respect, and I think he checked out some of the things that Marshall was saying.
Right.
He marked Marshall as a man to get to know. He respected his integrity, his ability to speak truth to power. And Pershing was like that, actually. He accepted criticism. Mm-hmm. So Pershing ended up pulling Marshall out of the 1st Division after the Cantigny battle, put him in headquarters. You know, and it was, in one way, it was great for Marshall's career for the rest of his life,
right?
Having had that experience. But on the other hand, it took him away from the command of troops. If he'd stayed with the 1st Division, he could well have been killed because in the,
so many
in the
were,
next big yeah. battle, they had huge casualties.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, he did survive and, yeah. you know, Pershing liked him and made him his aide for several years. And after that, he probably could have had his pick of assignments, but he wanted to go to the infantry school at Fort Benning. Why was that?
Actually, his first wife, he was married to a woman that he met right outside the limit gate of the Virginia Military Institute when he was a senior. And he married her. Her name was Lily Coles. And, you know, she saw him through the Philippine campaign in the early 1900s and then through World War I. But she died in 1927 following a risky operation. She had already had a heart condition. Mm-hmm. Marshall was really at a loss. You know, he wrote a letter to Pershing that said he felt lost. He doubted he could face the future. Anyway, he put out there he wanted to get away from the war college where he was in Washington, at what is now Fort McNair. He wanted to go somewhere, and he wanted to teach and train. So he got this assignment to become head of the academic program at Fort Benning, rural Georgia. And Benning gave him an opportunity to evaluate, assess, teach, and train dozens of the Army officers who would become generals in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know about it then, but he began keeping a so-called mythical black book. It was either a book in his head or a book in his back pocket.
No, and no one knows for sure which right. one it was.
And then finally, he was called to Washington into war plans in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
But the stepping stone was deputy chief of staff. And then the question was whether Eisenhower or whether Roosevelt would promote him to the chief of staff of the U.S. Army.
And that was an interesting one because, as I understand, there were five eligible candidates who, you know, were general officers and right. could serve out the full term. He was fifth out of the five in seniority. So why did Roosevelt pick him?
He had another Pershing-like moment with President Roosevelt. In 1938, when Marshall was just made deputy chief of staff, which was not necessarily a stepping stone to the big job.
Mm-hmm.
But Roosevelt called a huge meeting, November 1938, in the cabinet room, the White House. Roosevelt was wheeled in his wheelchair to sit at the head of the table. Marshall was back in an alcove because he was one of the least ranking people in the room. There were all the cabinet, a lot of cabinet officials, a lot of White House people, and all the Navy and the Army mm-hmm. chiefs of staff. And Roosevelt had this idea of basically mobilizing the U.S. productive capability and creating 10,000 planes. 10,000 planes was his objective. And the idea was to deter Hitler from any further moves in Europe by assembling a huge air force. Now, what Roosevelt wanted to do was sell those planes mm-hmm. To the French and the British and basically arm them so they would be the deterrent. He didn't say that exactly at the meeting, but he just said, my proposal is to build 10,000 planes. And they went around the room. He didn't ask everybody, but he went around the room basically to the key people. Everybody either said, "That's a great idea. Yes, that's mm-hmm. that's what we need to do." Nobody objected. Nobody sure. raised their hand and objected. But he got to the back of the room. And I guess he knew Marshall's name by that time. He said, because he called on him. He said, don't you agree with me, George? And Marshall bridled a bit because he didn't like to be, he felt if you were intimate with him, if you were a friend of his, you could call him George. But if you didn't have any, the idea of calling him George was something that sort of crossed the line with
too informal.
He didn't say anything, but he was mildly irritated. But
guess he stood up and said, no, Mr. President, I don't agree at all. The reason he didn't agree was a couple things. One, we had no army at that point. It was under 200,000, the size of Portugal or Belgium. So it's about 19th in the world. He felt we needed a balanced buildup. And also, you can't just create 10,000 planes. You got to have pilots, you've got to have air bases, and you got to have all the service equipment. Mm-hmm. So that was his reasoning. But once again, they trooped out of that room and all of his buddies said, bye-bye, George.
Right.
And then in April, Roosevelt called him in on a lazy Sunday. Roosevelt says to Marshall, I have it in my mind, the way he spoke, to appoint you Army Chief of Staff. What do you think of that? And Marshall reportedly replied, not that much, except you need to understand, if you do this, you know, I am going to say some things that might be unpleasant. And Roosevelt smiled and said, well, yeah, okay. And Marshall said, no, I'm serious. I saw you smile or something like that. This could be very unpleasant. That's just the way I am. And Roosevelt went ahead and appointed him. Mm-hmm. Again, he felt, this is a guy that's going to tell me the truth. He's not going to be a sycophant like a lot of the aides that I have. And I can trust him. He felt that he could trust him. And I think that was because
key
of the
element there. Yep. So, you know, he does get the nod. He jumps from 1 star to 4 stars.
Right.
And then goes on, you know, to oversee the massive troop buildup that you refer to. And, you know, through all this planning, you know, his planning expertise is recognized. And most of the U.S. and allied leaders are expecting him to be named, you know, commander of the Normandy invasion when the time comes. How did it end up going to Eisenhower instead?
Well, there was a lot of lobbying going on in Washington. And also, it had to do with Churchill. So in terms of the lobbying going on in Washington, yeah, everybody thought that Marshall was the natural one to be the commander of Overlord. But number one, what was going on in Washington was the other joint chiefs, King, Arnold. King had the Navy, mm-hmm. Arnold had the Army Air Force, and several others in Washington felt that it was much more important for Marshall to remain in Washington and to kind of keep these joint chiefs together mm-hmm. and basically dominate them as he did. Admiral Leahy came in later to make it the fourth. And there were columnists were writing about it. But the second thing was that if Marshall was a theater commander, which he would be in a Operation Overlord, mm-hmm. it would be a demotion. And there were some who were thinking, you know, that if they send Marshall to London to run the Operation Overlord, who's going to be taking care of controlling the Joint Chiefs? It'd probably be Eisenhower. And they were not used to him at all, and they didn't know whether he had the power, the force, the controlled power that Marshall exuded. Plus, Churchill. There was a conversation between Roosevelt and Churchill, and I guess at some point, Roosevelt said, of course, if we put Marshall into Operation Overlord, he will control the European theater. Mm-hmm. And Churchill said, no way. We control the Mediterranean. Marshall can have Western Europe. Again, that was another kind of demotion. Speculation would be that if Churchill had allowed Marshall to have all of Europe, Roosevelt may well have given him the command instead of Eisenhower. It was a close one. During this meeting they had in December 1943 in Cairo, that's when the decision was made. And Marshall refused to express his desire one way or the other. Mm-hmm. He let Roosevelt make the decision. And Roosevelt then said, I could not sleep at ease with you out of Washington. And so that meant the command is going to Eisenhower.
Don't monkey around with a winning team, right?
Yeah, don't monkey around with a winning team. Roosevelt had said that earlier. Mm-hmm. Yes. It was a quintessential moment that defines Marshall's character also because he didn't ask for it.
Right. So Marshall,
if he had demanded it, asked for it, made it clear that he wanted it, I don't know what would have happened, but I think Roosevelt would have given it to him because he had that stature at that time.
But he did what he thought was best for the country or let the president decide.
Let him decide. Mm-hmm.
So obviously, you know, with Eisenhower as commander of Overlord, you know, goes on after victory in Europe, Marshall then turns his full attention to planning against the Japanese. What were his thoughts about using the atomic bomb?
He was concerned about the the effect of the bomb in terms of really a dramatic change in warfare. He said, you know, you should not bomb civilians.
He saw a difference between using the atomic weapon versus, you know, powerful conventional.
Yeah, called a primordial weapon, meaning it's beyond anything we've done before. But he also didn't like the idea of massive civilian casualties. He thought there should be a warning of some kind.
So even though, you know, you had Marshall, you know, had recommended initially, you know, let's do a demonstration first. Once Truman did decide to use it,
Marshall
he was
did
fully
not
in support, right?
Yeah, you know, Marshall did not intervene further than that. Truman, I think, never looked back. Marshall never looked back. He never he supported the decision once it was made.
And then, you know, after the war, he found himself in a realm he wasn't always comfortable with necessarily, the political world versus the military one. So, Secretary of State with the Marshall Plan. And can you tell the listeners, you know, what exactly was the plan? Why did Marshall think it was so important? And why was he the only one who could put it through?
Well, he's made Secretary of State in early 1947, and without Truman as president. People were starving all over the continent of Europe. Freezing, starving. They had to figure out, you know, what are we going to do to revive this economy? So this was a trade deal. Marshall Plan was partly a trade deal. It was, we need the United States, not all altruistic. We need trade partners. They have to come up with an integrated plan for using the money. We'll supply the money, but they've got to come up with something that makes sense for each of their economies. They can't just ask for a bunch of money.
The Europeans themselves.
That's right. The Europeans. And so for the first time in 200 or 300 years, they're supposed to get together and stop fighting among themselves. This was the precursor to, you know, the EU. And the other thing that had to come along with it to complement it, because the Europeans who were trying to put this together said, we'll put together the plan, but who's going to protect us from the communists or from Russia? So that was a precursor to NATO. So Marshall Plan, trade deal, but you have to have defense in order to, for the whole thing to work. So then you had NATO. Where was Marshall in all this? You have Republicans controlling Congress, and you know, in a Democratic administration, and Marshall was the bridge. Marshall and Senator Vandenberg. Vandenberg was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He was a Republican, former isolationist. Marshall befriended Vandenberg. Marshall worked on Vandenberg, and the two of them were the voice of the Marshall Plan.
So they were able to convince you know, the Congress and the people that you know, this would prevent the rise of communism and it would help bring Europe together and lead to great trade possibilities.
The legislation went in two stages. It took almost a year for the whole thing to get through and for the money to be appropriated. Then it was $13 billion. Now it, you know, it was several you know, 100 times more than that in today's dollars.
And then we find, you know, his career isn't quite over yet. Truman calls him back into service for a final time as Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, let me say one thing about MacArthur if I can, but go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask you, so how would you characterize his handling of the Korean War and Douglas MacArthur at the time?
So, yeah, he came in after the outbreak of the Korean War. The surprising thing in my research and in my book is the deference that Marshall gave to General Douglas MacArthur, beginning in the 30s and well through and through the Korean War. You know, after Marshall did not get the command of Overlord in 1943, instead of going back home to Washington, he went out to see MacArthur, the only, you know, member of the high command who actually went out to the Pacific to assure MacArthur that we were going to support him. Marshall was like that with MacArthur. He took a lot of incoming from MacArthur, but he's magnanimous toward him. MacArthur was a hero in World War I, a true hero, and he made a lot of mistakes in World War II. But Marshall continued. He was the only guy in the East, the Far East, that really knew command of troops, and Marshall helped get him part of the Navy in the Pacific. In any event, Truman made up his mind to fire MacArthur. After MacArthur was insubordinate when the Chinese communists came across the Yalu in the, November and December of 1950. Truman made up his mind, but he wanted the Joint Chiefs to actually
go through the decision-making process. He wanted 100% agreement that it was time to fire MacArthur. Marshall, by then, was the civilian Secretary of Defense, and so he oversaw these meetings among the Joint Chiefs, and they went up through the chain of command, and they all ended up agreeing that it was time to, it was a question of how to do it, but they agreed that it was time to fire MacArthur. He was insubordinate, and they could know, and you know, that he was going to cause a Third World War if they didn't rein him in. But Marshall was the last one to put his imprimatur on, okay, it's time. And so Truman then knew none of his Joint Chiefs were going to talk behind his back. None of them were going to disagree. So he said, it's time to do it. So they fired him.
All right. Well, I mean, it's a long storied career. And I think you've done a great job in the book of helping introduce George Marshall to a new generation of readers so that he will be remembered as the defender of the Republic that he was. So I want to thank David L. Roll for being our guest. Again, the book is George Marshall, Defender of the Republic. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Joe.
And to all our listeners, thanks for joining. And be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Visit AUSA.org for more information. Keep it locked here for all Army Matters and for next week's special edition episode. Have a great Army Day.